like anything, I would recommend taking stock, figuring out what you can and cannot control. I break this down by recommending you look inward at yourself first. Look around you, at your job next. A really important piece is look at how your supervisor may or may not be a factor.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of World Strides Podcast, Changing Lives Through Education Abroad, a weekly series of conversations with international education's most interesting thought leaders, as well as discussions on emerging trends, best practices, and innovation happening in our field. I'm your host, Seth McInnes, and we have a very special episode on deck for our listeners today. We're going to zoom out a bit on the role of the modern study abroad professional and explore the wide variety of skill sets that one develops over time in this field. We are not only advisors and administrators, we're risk managers, we're statisticians, we're accountants, we're IT professionals, and a whole lot more. Education abroad professionals truly are the jack of all trades. We're going to explore this concept of international educators as a jack of all trades, or perhaps I should be saying a master of none, today with my dear friend, Kaylee Middleton. Kaylee is the Assistant Director of Education Abroad at the University of Vermont in lovely Burlington, Vermont. I know Kaylee to be an incredibly thoughtful colleague, and I always love kicking around ideas with her. I am thrilled to welcome her onto the pod. Our work in education abroad is incredibly rewarding, but it does ask a lot of us, doesn't it? While I like to think of our field as a calling, I'd be lying if I said I don't sometimes worry about burnout in our field. I know Kaylee does too. She has put a lot of thought into this topic and will explore burnout and share strategies to combat it. I am so excited for today's conversation. You do not want to miss this episode. Kaylee Middleton, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Zach.
I'm looking forward to our call today. It's a topic that's so relevant and one which we know will resonate with many listeners. To get us started, though, would you please give us an overview of your current role at the University of Vermont, where you currently serve as Assistant Director?
Sure. Thank you so much. As you mentioned, I'm Assistant Director of Education Abroad in the Office of International Education at the University of Vermont. So we're an inbound, outbound office, and I oversee all outbound study abroad, as well as leadership and management of the study abroad advising team. I've been here about a year and a half, but I've been in the field of international education for about 15 years. And when you ask this question, I can't help but go back to where it all started for me. And it all started with a dusty set of Encyclopedia Britannica books in my living room, and they had languages in the back of them. And as a kid, I would sit for hours and try to teach myself the languages in them, but I wasn't very successful. When it came time to go to college, I was a first-generation college student who studied French, the language that I preferred to learn, French and linguistics, at an engineering school in Maryland. Along the way, I decided I wanted to study abroad to develop my language skills, and I applied to ICEP, an ICEP exchange program, and I studied abroad in the south of France for an academic year and at Aix-Marseille University. After graduation, which was perfectly aligned with the Great Recession, I started out in international crisis management and international travel insurance. A lot of the international SOS and CISI types of work that we all are familiar with, I was in the trenches working in a call center that had international medical emergencies calling in from all over the world, and I served as a staff member who dealt with those emergencies and facilitated medical treatment for people who were around the world. I later moved into client relations management and dealt with policies for organizations, including universities that had international travel insurance components. As any good self-actualization story goes, I followed a guy who was in the military to Virginia, and when that didn't work out, it led me to pursue my master's in international higher education at Old Dominion University. There, I worked as a graduate assistant in the study abroad office, where my managers, Mike Dean and Steve Bell, taught me everything I know about being a study abroad advisor. I've worked at North Carolina State University in their study abroad office, as well as William & Mary in Virginia. A while ago, I moved back to Maryland and worked at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County for about 7 years, which leads me to where I am now. And each step along the way allowed me to collect different skill sets and experiences, even if I wasn't aware of it at the time.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Kaylee. We know that international educators such as ourselves wear many hats. There are many new colleagues in our field these days, so I'd like to ask you to start at the beginning. Beyond duties that might first come to mind, such as advising or running a pre-departure orientation, what are some examples of the other critical and perhaps higher level work that someone in a role like yours would engage in regularly?
First, I want to put my positionality out there, which is that I work at a public university and all of my experiences, aside from insurance, were at public universities. I also identify as a white cisgendered female, so I can't speak to identities outside of my own, those of which would have much to contribute to this work. Outside of the demographic of institution that I have experience with, I do see that there are probably a lot of alignments from different organizations or across different organizations. But when I look at the role I currently have, I see two complementary angles from our small study abroad perspectives. There's first the work that I do within the institution as lead for education abroad. That work involves admissions, advising, like you said, budgeting, marketing, programming, web development, risk management, instructional design, intercultural education, training, and awareness of policy and liaising with services such as counseling, accommodations, the registrar, financial aid office, among many others. The work that I do externally in my role, things that are beyond the institution, some of those hats would include partnership management, risk assessment, crisis response, knowledge of international business and communication practices, international law, and differences in international education systems. At managerial levels, the stakes get higher, and we need to have skill sets to interface with things like legal documents and facilitate international legal agreements and be able to extrapolate from international travel risk resources and communicate what those risks are to students and our own administration.
Fantastic, Kaylee. It's clear that our work is multifaceted and requires a lot more know-how than might be evident at first glance. What are some of the skill sets we develop as we progress in our roles?
This can look different for everybody, but for me in particular, it's really about strategic planning, public speaking. You cannot do this without being comfortable with public speaking, project development and execution, leadership and management, financial planning, assessment, negotiation, intercultural communication, and one of the most challenging, patience.
Hear, hear. And for fun, Kaylee, I'd love to ask you this question. What is something you've learned along the way in study abroad that you never thought would be part of your skill set?
You mean the things I didn't think I would need to know when I got a bachelor's in French and linguistics? I say this as a joke, but in all seriousness, how to troubleshoot a copier that's low on toner and not get ink all over yourself, that's a very underrated skill. Not as relevant anymore, but knowing how to send a fax. I learned how to fold a fitted sheet in my role, which is something that came along the way that was unexpected. But also making pivot tables in Excel or gap accounting and HTML.
I like to say that a study abroad office is almost a university in miniature, as it touches and liaises with other offices on campus more than any other, from academic advisors to the registrar to our friends in student and residence life. There are many connections we facilitate to ensure that transitions for our students are seamless. Could you share with us, please, how all of that communication and communal work means that international educators have an exceptional understanding of how a university works?
One important thing I've learned is that no university or organization is the same. I've been at 5 public universities, and all of them are very different. Just because that is my experience, or however I believe something worked at my previous institution, that doesn't mean it's going to work here or how the policies or decisions are made here. And that can sometimes be a little bit tricky to navigate. Don't make the assumption that all the inner workings or policies or procedures are entirely identical with similar institution types. One, it's really important in that vein to sit back and learn and examine the how and why of institutional policies and practices. And I've worked at a few places that have been around for hundreds of years and policies that are still written by hand in dusty old documents and archives somewhere. That can be a really important thing to keep in mind. Another thing that I carry with me, or an assumption that I lead with when I am doing this work, is that in most universities, study abroad, or the concept of study abroad, is an exception or not even a consideration of every single policy or process, from enrollment and registration to disability accommodations or to even international travel policies. You always have to learn how the work you're doing in study abroad might factor into policies that are seemingly written in stone. it's critical to see your campus colleagues as support and collaborators and find ways to work with them and work together versus seeing them as barriers. Something I learned early on was that you need to find ways to share your story and make these people your friends. One of my early mentors told me that whenever I travel for work, I should bring something back, small, even if it's candy or something that costs 50 cents or a dollar, and bring it to all of those people that you work with on campuses. And it's not a bribe. It's more building goodwill and showing that, giving them a window into the work that you're doing, along with sharing the student stories and experiences that are happening.
I love everything you said. Thank you for that, Kaylee. We've been talking about how our roles stretch us on a daily basis, and I'd love to dig a bit deeper here. While we know that many international educators call this field their professional home for the long term, could you share with us what to be some of the most transferable skills practitioners like our listeners develop along their career path?
First and foremost, our work is project management down to a T, and we know that project management is a very lucrative profession. There's also client relations, partnership development. Talk about negotiation skills when you're explaining to your legal team the cultural implications of terms in an international exchange agreement. Other skills involve creative problem solving, diplomacy, academic advising, and knowledge of systems and how to navigate within them.
Let's shift gears a bit. Ask anyone who's received a happy photo from a student abroad or a grateful email from a faculty travel leader, and it's clear. We have some of the most meaningful and uplifting jobs out there. That said, our field does tend to ask a lot of us. Let's rip the Band-Aid off. Burnout exists in international education like it exists within the rest of higher ed. I know you to be very thoughtful on this. Could you first define for us what burnout is for the purposes of our conversation today, and perhaps share some common symptoms?
Absolutely. And I'm really glad you asked this because I'm determined to keep this topic an active part of the conversation. And how I would define burnout, which is a pretty clinical definition, is a state of emotional, physical, and mental exhaustion caused by prolonged stress or excessive workload. It can occur when someone feels overwhelmed, emotionally drained, and unable to meet the constant demands of their job, personal life, or both. And it can lead to feelings of detachment, cynicism, reduced efficiency, and a lack of accomplishment.
What do you think is unique about education abroad that contributes to burnout?
Where to even start? There are a lot of fields that are experiencing widespread burnout currently. Education is certainly one of them at all levels, not just higher education. I would say that elementary and high school education are experiencing this too. And I would also guess that the service industry and healthcare are up there. What about our jobs, though, I would say is that our jobs are never done. And it's hard to really quantify what our work is or articulate in really specific terms what the job is from day to day. For example, the emails don't stop, ever. Don't try. They're not going to. We also work across time zones. An average 9-to-5 day is not something we really have the luxury of working within all the time. We also have situations that are time sensitive and can even be critical. And it can also be hard to figure out what needs to be done versus what would be nice to do. And not all universities or roles are like this, but my position is a salaried position that has, it's not defined by a specific set of work hours each week. Rather, and per HR policy, it says, I have a body of work I'm assigned and I should consider my work satisfactory when the job is done and I can leave for the day when that is done. I don't think I've ever left a single day thinking that I've done everything I need to do. And that can be really hard to define on a day-to-day basis.
That's very insightful. I think about the time zone piece a lot myself. Yesterday, I was up early for a 7 a.m. meeting with a colleague in Australia and then stayed late to have another meeting with someone in New Zealand at 6 p.m. The work never ends. But perhaps more than ever, though, our field is a dynamic one. What are you noticing about burnout, specifically in 2024?
It is an overlap of a lot of things. And for those of us who've been around since 2020 or even before, we can all remember all that pent-up demand we were talking about. How about the term pivot that we heard constantly in 2020 and 2021? And the Great Resignation. All of these things are overlapping, and we're still grappling with the new landscape of international education. Some institutions at that time took on new portfolios, such as domestic study away. Others had to adapt to new concepts or models like COIL, which stands for Collaborative Online International Learning, and that being either a part of or a substitution to study abroad. There's the staffing shortages that never seem to be resolved or backfill. Take that with increased student demand, as well as the psychological and cultural traits of this generation of students who now seem to require more support and seem to have more critical incidents than before, can be all really hard to balance. There's our calendars. I don't know about you, but when I think back to a few years ago, I don't remember having back-to-back meetings consistently, jumping from virtual meeting to virtual meeting with no time in between. Do you remember this being the case before Zoom and other platforms?
I certainly have experienced what you're talking about now. But
some days I feel a sense of whiplash. I don't think it's sustainable, and I am grateful for the technology that these virtual platforms have brought us, but I also think it's a little bit of a slippery slope because we have this access now, virtual meeting software and platforms that has destroyed our ability to manage our time better. Our schedules aren't sustainable anymore. We are meeting more often, or we're meeting because it's more convenient and accessible, but it takes up time we'd otherwise use for doing actual work. I remember having a meeting, having to walk physically from one office to another in a different part of campus or on an organization. And that was doable. And now 12 o'clock, time for me to hop into my next call, and you're constantly switching gears. And that's not really great for anybody psychologically.
And it doesn't give you the time to catch up on all the work that was discussed in those meetings, right?
No, it sure does not.
I know Kaylee identify as a mid-career professional. So do I. And you've been in the field a while. And now you have supervisory duties at UVM with a wonderful team of advisors that you have there. How have you seen conversations evolve around burnout over the past few years?
We need to keep the idea of burnout in our psyche and in our conversations. It contributes to staff attrition. It's a fairly new term, and I'm glad it has taken shape and become part of the conversation. And as you said, I do identify as a millennial. And I think that one of the traits of my generation, our generation, is that we carry this mentality that our work needed to be our passion. I'm guilty of that, for sure. I chose a career that feels meaningful and has an impact. I'm good at it. I do think, though, that it hurt us in some ways, because somewhere along the way, you have the risk of tying your own identity and self-worth to the success of your work. And when everything falls apart, which can cause a lot of crisis of identity, lack of fulfillment in your work, lack of stability in your job, that I see the conversation shifting. And I'm hopeful around it that this work should no longer be full of passion and sacrifice, but a little bit more of a balance.
And I know you to be a great manager who isn't afraid to tell team members it's okay to sign off and go home. You've done your work for the day. As Kaylee, we all know that burnout is related to workplace culture. And that's something that none of us can shift all on our own. That said, I know our listeners to be smart and capable. And we can take steps to combat and prevent burnout and make our own teams and offices a better place to work. Could you share with our listeners some of your personal strategies and tips?
I can't take full credit here. And as you've mentioned, I've done a few presentations at conferences over the past few years with some stellar colleagues on this topic whose brightness I can only hope to aspire to. And there have been multiple conversations and sessions at conferences that have built upon each other through the collegial nature in our field. And I'm grateful for that. What I'm sharing about burnout comes from the work of many who have been working on this for the past few years. One of the first things to put into play as a strategy is remember that you are more than your job. I am not only a study abroad advisor or a manager at a university or a leader of study abroad at the University of Vermont. I am more than that. But it's up to you to figure out what that is for you and how to bring more of that into your life. You also have to work on developing boundaries between your job and your personal life that allow both to flourish. Like I said a few minutes ago, it's easy to get really stuck in the, all right, 10 more emails or this one thing needs to be taken care of. And that's going to creep into your personal life. And it's going to take away from your ability to do things that are more fulfilling or allow more balance. If you think of the analogy of putting all your eggs in one basket, don't let that be your career. Spread your eggs out and nurture the ones that allow you to have more balance, whether it's maybe your personal relationships or hobbies or rest or things that aren't international education.
I love it. Thanks for sharing that, Kaylee. Burnout is a personal thing. and it can happen to any of us at any point in our careers. What words of wisdom might you have for our colleagues about taking care of themselves?
I would say that burnout doesn't have a cure of self-care or a mental health day. And that's important to remember. You can need those things and still do make space for them, but it's more complex than that. Like anything, it might require a lot of work and personal development and confronting hard things. There are also potential intersections with mental health issues that might require professional intervention. That requires asking for help. These things are all hard. If I were to generalize advice around it, I would say first, be curious and explore what its underlying causes. Is it workload? Is it lack of autonomy and job satisfaction? Is it work-life imbalance or injustice that you're observing? Is it unclear expectations? Is it work culture, such as not understanding your role or expectation in your role? Is it toxicity in the work environment? Or are there outside stressors? Like anything, I would recommend taking stock, figuring out what you can and cannot control. That's also something that is hard to learn in your adulthood. I break this down by recommending you look inward at yourself first. Look around you, at your job next. A really important piece is look at how your supervisor may or may not be a factor. When you're looking inward, think about what is your why? What in this work energizes you? For me, I love the times that I can be in front of students and teaching. I feel full of joy and excitement, and I feel fulfilled, and I get excited and energized when I do that. And I consider things like our pre-departure orientation, teaching opportunity, and even if it's nerdy and dumb, I get really excited and I pour my experience and creativity into it. Then look at what depletes you. Where's your energy going, and what's leaving you feeling overwhelmed? And I can tell you that currently my team had a big application deadline, and the chaos that inherently comes with that leaves room for nothing else, and we're depleted at the end. It's the endless administrative processing, the emails, the people who miss the deadline and who are upset, and you have to spend time dealing with the upset people. That is all draining. It's not something you can really control, but it's something that has to be done. So notice that there are things that give you energy and things that take your energy. Then look around at your job. What's the 10,000-foot view? Can you find trends in your job on a semesterly or quarterly or annual basis? Our jobs don't tend to be constant year-round. There are ebbs and flows. And what are key busy times? Think about the start of the academic term. Program start dates, deadlines. Those are the times to focus only on the urgent priorities. Nothing new, nothing extra. No to new ideas. No to meetings that aren't critical. No to things that would be nice but aren't important. But then when are the down times? For me in my current role, it's mid-December to mid-January, May and June, sometimes in July. Those are the times to replenish. In a university position like mine, it's important to understand what is and is not within my control. That can be really hard because you're working within systems and you have your own priorities, but I don't personally control university policy, and I may feel something needs to be discussed or changed to improve the work that I need to do or that I believe I need to do, but I have very little agency to affect that change. What are my options there? I can raise the concern and highlight the issue to my superiors. I can document what that looks like. I can share what I believe the implications are and make a recommendation, but taking on that issue and trying to change it is an uphill battle. It's like trying to bang against a brick wall. Try to remember that sometimes situations that aren't aligned with what your responsibilities and influence are. And I have a good example of this, and that's come up multiple times in my career, which is that some university accounting offices or procurement or whatever, or accounts payable, have struggled with international business practices. And to me, it's a no-brainer. You need to make payments in international currency. It's expected that we'll get bills in euro or pounds or whatever currency, but to university accounting, who make payments across the university all the time, they have their own systems and sometimes make it more complex. And sometimes I've been told that we cannot make payments in this currency. We need a bill in US dollars, which is a hard thing or almost an impossible thing to expect of international partners. And so I can only work within that knowledge at times and try not to change it. And that can take a lot of creative problem solving. Lastly, your supervisor or your management can be tricky territory. Examine your relationship with your supervisor. I have a great supervisor currently, and I trust them to help me with having my back and helping me be my best. But some folks don't always feel that way, and that's an unfortunate reality that sometimes comes up in your jobs. How do you contend with that? How do you make decisions when your boss isn't able to be clear with you? And that's an entirely different conversation. What can you do versus what should you do in those cases is an entirely separate conversation.
I love everything you said once again, my friend. One of the things that I had to learn in my career was the importance of saying no. When I was in my 20s, I would say yes to every committee and say yes to every meeting. Then I started experiencing burnout. I try to be intentional about what it is I say yes to now. I don't always succeed. So I'd love for you to speak to that as well.
It's funny you said that. And we have I have a weekly team meeting with my staff. And one of the things we did this week was talk about how we're feeling burned out and saying no. And I made us all sit and practice. And I said, I'm going to count to three and we're all going to say no. And I would count to three and it's one, two, three, no. And I would do it until everyone said it with confidence. And then I would put out ridiculous suggestions. And I would say to one of my staff, I'd like you to create a new presentation for this partnership that we want to work on. Will you do this by the end of the week? No. And I would say to a different staff member, there's a student asking for an exception or for something that isn't possible and they want to meet with you this week when we have all this stuff to do and you have no time. Can you do that? No. No doesn't mean never. No doesn't mean it's not possible. It means not now or not in this way. When you're trying to figure out how to balance not seeming insubordinate or uncooperative versus what you're capable of, we can't necessarily contend with everything that comes our way. And in terms of me saying no, sometimes I'd have to decide if, does this need an answer right now? I'm going to close my laptop. And sometimes I use the tools at my disposal. I will snooze emails for a week so I don't have it in front of me. That's a tool that my email server has. If you don't have that, there are other ways you can do things like that. Another tool I have is something that I've presented a few times in my sessions at NAFSA, which is called the Eisenhower Matrix. I keep it on my wall. It's a silly little visual guide to show you how to make decisions when you are not able to think through things. It has four squares. You can Google it, but you're asked to identify what's urgent versus important. If something's urgent and important, make it a priority. If it's urgent but not important, can you delegate it? If it's not urgent but important, schedule it. And if it's not urgent or important, delete it. That might be hard to do, but I've noticed in my career that things that need to be addressed tend to pop up time and time again, and there will be an opportunity to fix something down the line if it becomes a pattern.
We love the Eisenhower Matrix here on Changing Lives for Education Abroad. Thank you for that. Kaylee, if you had three wishes, what would they be related to education abroad, burnout, and the future of our field?
My biggest wish would be to keep this conversation at the forefront. We have an awesome field. We have awesome colleagues who are talented and very awesome people. And keeping this conversation at the forefront is going to allow us to make sure that we are taking care of ourselves and each other. And somewhat related wish I would have is set a different tone and culture about what this type of role should be, especially in relation to our compensation and ability. None of us have ever said, I'm going to be a study abroad advisor because I want to be rich and wealthy. And that's never going to change, I don't think. But I do think we've made some progress along the way of the requirements for positions like this and the compensation that goes with it. Sometimes these jobs, especially at universities, don't pay enough to retain people. How can we balance that with what's in our control? Or how can we change the expectations of the role to make it seem less of a sacrifice and passion project versus you're doing a job that you're qualified for and good at, and there can be a balance of both? And lastly, I don't know if you would agree or not, but does anyone have the secret to getting students to listen and follow instructions? It's not email. It's not email. It's not having it on your website. Can someone tell me or figure it out for all of us? Because that would really help a lot.
I'm starting to think we should do a podcast episode on how to get students to follow instructions.
And by the time you do that, it'll change.
Absolutely. But thank you, Kaylee. That is inspiring and that is helpful. Many of us see our colleagues more every day than our partners or friends. A big part of being happy in the modern workplace is our supervisor. You yourself are a manager. How do you approach that role with care for your team members at the forefront?
I take this very seriously, and I have imposter syndrome about this all the time. I even listened to your episode with Sarah Dart about imposter syndrome. And sometimes it means trying to do your best, and it's not always going to look pretty. But in my current role, I supervise four full-time professionals. There are lots of folks out there who have larger teams and have a lot more responsibility. My perspective is a pretty humble one, but I'll share what I've developed and what I know. I try to be, and don't always succeed, at being the most supportive supervisor I can. And the first thing that I try to remember is that I should set a good example when I can. Try not to work outside of normal work hours when it can be helped. Take leave myself, take breaks, and actually unplug during those times. Try not to work when I'm sick so that it makes space for my team to do the same. There's nothing that is critical or urgent in most cases that we need to be able to be accessible on our off time. Some people have that built into their roles, that's true, but I do think that being able to fully unplug and allowing your staff to do that is something that's important. I also try to notice when I'm experiencing burnout myself, times that I'm not bringing my best manager self to my workplace. We are all susceptible to getting downtrodden or getting frustrated or getting depleted. I try to take space when this happens, and it's really hard. I know that it's better for me to step away when I'm having those feelings than it is for me to bring that attitude in front of my team, because they really do pay attention and sometimes catch on or catch the feelings that you're having. That's not to say we shouldn't show vulnerability and demonstrate weakness, but we should do what we can to set a positive, hopeful, or inspiring tone for our staff. On the other hand, part of my job is to set the goals and direction of our work and manage workload. I myself get underwater and can lose sight of this. I feel that way this week. When I notice that this is happening, I know it's an important time for me to look around at how my team is doing and try to help calibrate what expectations are and what priorities are. And making decisions around priorities can be tough, especially for a manager when you feel like you're responsible for so much. And I try to make space for letting go of things in favor of staff well-being. We're in cold and flu season, and we've had people taking turns having colds and the flu. Part of our day-to-day work is giving advising sessions or presentations, and we give about 4 to 6 group information or advising sessions per week. These sessions tend to fill to capacity, 15 to 30 students. And there have been a few times where staff have opted to come in sick and do these sessions because they were assigned to them versus not doing them because they felt it was a priority. And that's something we talked about in our meeting in the past week is what is the balance there? What is the balance of canceling one of those? It's inconvenient to cancel something that 15 to 30 students have signed up for, that they're expecting to attend to get the information that they want or are seeking. But what is the greater cost of a staff member coming in, potentially making others sick, potentially getting more sick? The relative inconvenience is nothing compared to making sure that your staff's well-being is prioritized. I also think it tells a story of what capacity you have, what resources you have versus what you think you should be doing to serve the clients or students on your campus. Also, for me, I love strategy. I love ideas. I love projects. I love new ideas and fixing things. And I really have to rein it in when I get those thoughts and inspiration. I have to work to hold off on moving forward with those in favor of balance and really decide what's important to do. I mentioned a few minutes ago, what are the downtimes in your annual workload cycle? And I no longer really strive to have an endless to-do list of projects during those times, but really, where can we make progress on one or two things, do some maintenance that'll make our next big cycle easier? That takes a lot, especially when you've spent X number of hours, and it's never as simple as that, fixing something that it could potentially have a bigger payout in the future. Another thing that is important to remember is you need to give people opportunities to shine and do their best work, and work that is joy-giving. And that's different for everybody. We all have the emails and the administrative processing and the spreadsheets and the questions and the students and everything. And that can get draining. Where do people get excitement? Where are they interested in their roles? Where do they want to grow? For some people, it's strengthening partnerships and developing those relationships. For others, it's being creative and creating new content or working on something that's interesting and different. Where can we build in opportunities for this type of work to bring more interest and joy into their day-to-day? Lastly, I would say it's taking on the responsibility of hard decisions. I really appreciate and love that our field tends to be collaborative, and I try to manage in a collaborative way, but there are times when I think it's not fair to my team to ask them to make an important decision or to help me make an important decision. I certainly want their input and perspective, and I want to hear things from as many angles as possible, but sometimes you have to make the tough call. Stick with it, regardless of what the implications are, and stand by it, even if it's hard. And giving space to your team to not have that pressure on them can be really important.
We know that institutions of higher education can be slow to change, even if there is a visionary leader in place in a pivotal position. Let's break it down. What are some ways managers can seek to advance change despite obstacles or institutional barriers?
Let me know what ideas you have, because I'm taking notes. I'm content in my role now and my position, but that doesn't mean I want my advancement to stop. And we have budgets, we have staff, we have responsibilities, but it's still important to focus on your own professional development and what that can look like, even if you're not looking to make a move at the moment. There's always going to conferences, but what else is there? There can be serving as a mentor, learning new skill sets, continuing to develop your professional network and connections and foster them. The question you asked was advancing change despite obstacles and institutional barriers. These are ways that you can do that because you're learning different perspectives. You're learning how others might approach something. You're learning strategies and skills that might be able to be used or filed away to be used later. What is the ultimate outcome of the goal, or what is the ultimate change that you're trying to effect? Exploring things, having conversations, all of those things lead to change over time. That can be a valuable way to approach things. On the other hand, I would say that when there are things that are causing harm to people, to whether it's your team or your students, those things do need to be brought to the forefront and to the attention of people who are in a position to address them.
Managing and leading teams is not an easy thing. What are some lessons you have learned along the way that our listeners might find helpful?
Oof, if any of my previous managers are listening, I'm sure that they would die of shock to hear how I would answer that question. One of the big things that has been really hard to learn is figure out how to go from doing all the work, and you're hired as a manager because you know how to do all of the work at almost all of the levels that you're responsible for. But you have to let go of doing it yourself, and you need to create systems that allow for your staff to do the work. That is really tricky and murky. What does the system look like? How do you document it? How do you articulate it in a way that makes sense to others and not just you? Getting out of the weeds in order to lead and be strategic is one of the first things that is key to leading a team. When it comes to managing, letting go of perfectionism. I know what my expectations are of myself and what I would consider high quality work. What is good enough versus what is the way I would do it? What can wait versus what I would like to do? Those are things that can be helpful. Is it good enough to address the task at hand? Let it be fine.
I often talk to team members here at World Strides about not letting perfection be the enemy of the good. Sometimes the email is good enough to send. I love what you said there. But let's go meta, Kaylee. How have your past experiences with leaders in other roles shaped your approach to leadership today?
There are some truly inspiring leaders out there, and I am grateful to have access to those in the field and able to be observant of those in the field who really embody leadership. And some of the things that I see or I've learned is to get to know your people, see them, treat them as humans with full lives. Your importance as a leader should never overshadow the attention that you give to your people. It's okay to want to continue to develop yourself and build on your own profession and advancement, but not at the expense of your staff or your colleagues. Developing your staff and your colleagues and working to retain them is one of the best things that you can do to enhance your workplace and invest in your own success. There is also nothing more important than developing empathy and respect for others. You're allowed to disagree. You're allowed to dislike people. You're allowed to have opinions about how things should be done, but you're not allowed to be disrespectful or not treat people with the humanity they deserve. And that unfortunately comes up at times. This is not advice for my own staff. I hope that they're not hearing this and thinking, Kaylee, get over yourself. But something that I learned early on is the role of credit in our work. And I remember getting this advice as a grad student that anything that I can do in my job and in my day to make the leader of my team, whether it's my boss or my boss's boss, look good, supports our work as a whole. Everything is going towards lifting up that person who's appointed to be leader. And that has really been a huge takeaway for me, that I don't need personal credit as long as something is propping up or supporting or lifting up the director who I need to have influence. Don't forget your own development and your own professional connections. Every connection, every networking opportunity can have an important role in your success. And as we say all the time, our field is small.
I love it. You made me think of one of my favorite lessons from my current supervisor, the wonderful Jennifer Fisher. When I was promoted into leadership, one of the best pieces of advice she's ever given me was that as you grow in your career, there's going to be more and more demands on your time, but you should always make sure that your team members are your first priority. And I try to embody that every day. But as we begin to wrap up here, Kaylee, I have one more question for you. As you think about education abroad in 2024, what makes you hopeful?
We're seeing the field rebound and flourish. It was hard for a few years. We weren't sure what it was going to look like. And there's still a lot of uncertainty. Something that's remained pretty consistent is that students are still going abroad for a lot of the same reasons, and they're coming back with growth and significant development. And at this stage in my career, I've learned that development doesn't stop when they come back home. It continues throughout their lives. It comes back and serves them in ways later. It's done that for me. I still take lessons and learn new things from my time as a study abroad student that I wasn't expecting. Almost, this is going to sound corny or Miss America-y, but the world peace aspect of the work that we do. Allowing people the opportunity or an educational experience to develop a better understanding of the world and hopefully some skills that contribute to their ability to tolerate and embrace difference rather than fear it is something that is only going to make our society stronger. And those are the things that make me hopeful. Even when I have a million students going to one single location in one country every semester, there's still the potential there.
I can't imagine a better place to end things than here. Kaylee Middleton, thank you so much for being here. What a joy this conversation was.
Thank you so much, Zach.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode of Changing Lives Through Education Abroad. I'm your host, Zach McInnes, and please make sure to join us next week as we continue to explore topics around international education and exchange. Thank you to my spectacular World's Rights colleagues, Lindsay Kelscher and Sarah Kachuba, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Please subscribe to Changing Lives Through Education Abroad on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And share with your friends and colleagues. Let's create life-changing moments together.